Welcome to the Global Council podcast, where you can hear the GC team discuss and debate topical developments in public policy and regulation from around the world.
Hello, I'm delighted to be joined today by Augusto Santos Silva, who is a veteran of Portuguese politics, who's held many ministerial positions, and since 2015 has been Portugal's foreign minister. Minister de Augusto, hello, warm welcome to you. Portugal has held the EU's rotating presidency for the first half of this year. So as foreign minister, you have been right in the heart of the action. We've seen progress on the Commission's main goals on the EU's twin priority transitions, green and digital, and Portugal held its social summit last month in advance to advance the European pillar of social rights. Your presidency slogan was, if I'm right, time to deliver a fair, green, and digital recovery. So let me ask you, first of all, how many marks out of 10 would you give yourselves? I mean, how in concrete terms has the last 6 months made the EU fairer, greener, and more digitalized?
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. Well, this is a very tricky question, because you don't give marks to yourself. But if I am allowed to give marks to my team, people from the European Affairs Department and people from our permanent mission in Brussels, I would say that perhaps 7 out of 10, we deserve it. At least this mark they deserve. Because as you very rightly pointed out, our slogan was very practical and pragmatic, time to deliver. And why did we choose this slogan? Because in our view, the main strategic decisions were made by the European leaders last year. First in July, when they decided to launch the Recovery and Resilience Fund. This means adding to our regular multi-annual budget a program specifically targeting the need of fostering a recovery and preserving the internal market. So this semester, the need we had was to implement this decision. And second main decision taken by the European leaders in the second semester of 2020 was to join efforts in what regarded the vaccination. The decision that the European Commission would purchase vaccines for all of us, and then the vaccines were to be allocated to member states in a pro rata proportion considering their population. So again, in this semester, it was time to deliver, to roll out the vaccination process.
Okay. If you had to identify any sort of single biggest achievement of the presidency, because I'm going to come on to the recovery fund and ask you about that in a moment. But if you had to think of one, what would be the biggest achievement of the presidency in your view?
Well, the emphasis on the social dimension of the European integration. So the emphasis that we need the European social model to achieve the double transition. This idea is a very key one. We have to do the digital transformation of our industries and our public administration and of our education on one hand, and on the other hand, we have to achieve the green transition of our economy in terms of its sustainability Of course, we have to engage more and more in the climate action and combating the climate change. If we want to do this, we have to do it with the citizens. We cannot afford to risk our citizens and our middle classes and our working class can feel that they are abandoned, that now we have priorities that do not match their anxiety, but also their project. So the idea that no one is to be left behind, the idea that we have a triangle. In one phase, you have the digital transition. In another phase, you have the green transition. But to support this, you need another phase, the social dimension of European integration. This idea was very heart of our presidency.
I think what you're saying is really very interesting indeed, you know, for this reason, and it's personal to me. When I was trade commissioner, I was responsible for liberalizing trade and opening up markets. My colleague in the commission, the competition commissioner, was responsible for introducing greater competition into Europe's markets. But that it was oftentimes the member states and their own national competencies that were responsible for evening out the social impacts of what we were doing in Brussels. So we were, in a sense, were the economic liberals, but we looked to member states to be more the, as it were, the social democrats. But here was the problem. It was very difficult to get all the member states to act in a uniform, and I would say, and you possibly would say, social democratic way. And I saw in the social summit that a number of member states, for example, underline their own national competence on minimum wages. Now, do you think that quite a few of our member states might, you know, support your agenda in theory, but are nonetheless rather more indifferent to the EU itself taking a bigger role in driving that social agenda because they want to retain their own national competence?
Yes. Well, first of all, we have to recognize the facts. And the fact is, to a certain extent, the social dimension is a competence of member states. So if we think of social security policies, education policies, even health policies, they are at the core of the competences of a national state. And I do understand why. I would not like to let to the European Commission the full responsibilities of the national governments in what regards education, work policies, industrial relations, or
health policy. I mean, was it not a feature of the pandemic that the Commission, that the EU itself, didn't have sufficient responsibility or a role in relation to health policy, which made things more difficult to coordinate?
Well, personally, I would respond that we need two things at the same time. First, to preserve the national responsibilities regarding these social policies in the broad sense of the word. And on the other hand, we need more coordination at European level. That's why the action plan for implementing the European pillar of social rights that the European leaders decided in the Porto summit was based on what we call, you remember it certainly, the method of open coordination. Yes. And that's, we decide common targets. We decide common commitments. We decide what will be the metrics, the criteria through which we will assess our performance regarding these objectives. We define the calendar, the timeline of these assessments, And then each member state is free to choose its path, but it's committed to obtain to reach the common objectives, the common targets that we have defined together.
Well, Augusta, let me ask you then about that precisely in relation to climate change and climate action. Do you think it's enough for the EU to determine the timeline and the destination, but not the means and the speed at which member states travel in that direction? There's now a fragile consensus, at least about long-term targets, and those targets and those benchmarks have now been agreed in the Union. The Fit for 55 package is going to make much more explicit how costs are going to be shared. But at the same time, as the EU is trying to build international support for very ambitious emissions reduction, do you think that that consensus within the EU about those targets and about the ambitious emission reduction benchmarks that have been agreed, is that consensus going to be sustained, do you think? But also, secondly, do you think it's enough to set the timelines and the targets and simply allow then the member states to go in their own way?
Well, I think that there are two different sort of things or problems. In terms of social policies, I do believe that the open coordination method is the adequate methodology and the only one that is allowed by the treaties. But in that sense, in the open coordination method, you have a political commitment. You are politically committed to certain targets, to a certain timeline, and to certain milestones. But in the case of the climate action, this is not enough. That's why if you would ask me for the single outcome of the Portuguese presidency, I would respond with no doubt that this single accomplishment was the approval of the European climate law. And the targets, the timelines, the methods, the calendars, the resources, the obligations in this framework are not only political, but also legal. They are binding. So that's the difference. If we want to reach our objectives, carbon neutrality by 2050, reduction of at least 56% of our emissions by 2030, you need not only to have political commitments, but also legally binding commitments.
Yeah, you have legally binding commitments, but you also, I think you would agree, continue to have political differences amongst member states and their governments. I mean, do you think that we could see divisions over climate action and the agenda that's been agreed resurfacing amongst some of the member states between those in the West and the South, like yourselves, and others in the center and the east of the Union who have greater misgivings?
Yes, we could, but we shouldn't. Because the objectives, the targets that we have defined represented the consensus, a minimum common denominator between the member states. Some of us will be quicker than the others and will be more ambitious in what regards the final targets. But I have to admit and to recognize that the starting points are completely different. For instance, Portugal was one of the European countries, one of the first European countries to bet, to invest a lot, to choose the way of the renewable energies. And the reason is very simple, because we don't have gas, we don't have oil. We import all the oil and all the gas we use. That's of our interest to develop as soon as we can our solar, our hydric, or our eolic energy. Exactly the opposite happens with Poland. Poland has a substantial commitment by now to carbon, to coal, to fossil energy. So they have to do a much more intensive effort than the one Portugal needs to do. So the consensus that was defined was also a balance between these different resources, different situations of the countries. Okay. Additionally, and unfortunately, we have now in Europe, within the European Union, very different views on what Europe is, what Europe would be, on what are the values and institutions that define the European Union, and also on topics as climate action, and many others. The diversity of Europe is very large. For a long time, it has been one of its main resources, but now, beyond being a resource, it is also a source of problems and divergence among the member states.
Let me, if I may, take you back to what you said a few minutes ago about the need to carry public opinion. I mean, not just the better off middle class public opinion, but working class opinion, and people who, who don't find it easy to bear additional costs in their daily lives. Do you think that there is a danger in Europe that we are underestimating the potential public backlash that could arise when people realize what the implications are and the costs of the climate action that we've been agreed, that, just as France saw its gilets jaunes, that we may see similar groundswells and revolts in other European countries? I mean, how worried are you about carrying public opinion in these ambitious goals as these cost implications become more and more apparent to people?
Well, I must say that as a socialist, as a social democrat, I'm very concerned. We cannot have the risk of abandoning our people. For instance, in Portugal, the far right valued for 10% in our last presidential election. So we have to be very careful. We have to speak to the people, whatever are their political opinions, whatever is their vote. But we have to speak to all, and we have to encompass all groups, all interests in this process. And for this, we have to be very clear in our political discourse. The green transition and the digital transition are the drivers of the new economy. So they have to be the main resources of an economic transformation, besides being an economic recovery, but an economic transformation that has to create employment, that has to create wealth, and wealth to be redistributed among the people. So if you allow me for a certain minute for, in a certain way, a partisan political discourse, I think that redistribution is not obstacle.
I don't mind at all, because when I talked to Frans Timmermans the other month, we dwelled on this quite a lot. And he, like you, is a social democrat, and like me as well. Now, His response to me was, no, Peter, it's going to be a just transition. That we are going to make sure that, you know, we're not taking from the poor and redistributing, you know, climate action, as it were, to the better off. We're going to make sure that this is not an onerous transition on people who can least afford to bear its costs. But this does require quite a complex set of policies to make sure that our climate action interacts with the justice of this transition and the financial transfers that are needed to individuals, their families, car owners, homeowners, who are going to have to carry out an enormous amount of this transition. Do you really think we're up to that sophistication, that complexity of policy?
Well, I do think that we have a chance. But in order to understand that chance, we have to put at the same time to take into consideration at the same time the economic transformation. That's one of our mottos, greening our economy, digitalizing our economy, and maintaining our technological edge, or the recovering our technological edge on one side, and on the other hand, to draw all the conclusions that we need to draw from the idea of recovering or enhancing the strategic autonomy of Europe. What does this mean? This means as well a lot of opportunities for European industry, for European trade, for European services, because one of the most important lessons of the pandemic is that we cannot allow that basic goods that we need are dependent on value chains that are far distant from us, not only or mainly geographically, but institutionally. So we have at the same time to do this economic and social transformation of Europe, but at the same time, we need to enhance Europe's autonomy. And this will mean that we will have to re-industrialize Europe. So for me, as a social democrat, these are not antagonist drivers, climate action and the reindustrialization of the economy.
So do you think that, and let's look at the economy for a moment, do you think that the recovery fund, which is the centerpiece of the EU's plan to, you know, to secure its recovery in the short and longer term, with its own resources decision, which has now been ratified by EU member states, do you think that that recovery fund and the economic path that it's taking should embrace, in a sense, protection of European industry so that Europe's economy and its industry becomes more self-reliant, less dependent on global supply chains and supply from other countries? Is that an important feature in your view?
Yes, but I would not use the verb to protect. I would use the verb to invest. I don't mind international competition. On the contrary, I think that international trade is one of the main drivers of the global growth of economy and the progressive transformation of societies throughout the world. So I do praise international trade, and I do want competition. Competition, of course, on a level playing field, respecting the level playing field. But I would say that we have to reinforce the factors of European competition in an open global market. That's one of the main purposes of the recovery plan, to but invest.
Would you also want, sorry to interrupt, but you also want greater autonomy of European production.
Yes.
So tell me, who then sort of designs, who is painting this canvas? The one that says, well, we're open to trade, but we want to promote competition, but we also want to develop European production. I mean, who is painting this canvas for Europe?
Well, I think that the European Commission has its own responsibilities, and at the end of the day, it is the European Council that defines our strategy. But I don't want to be misunderstood. I want a stronger Europe in an open competition. And for that purpose, we have to be smarter in our economic relations with third parties, not only with the United States, but also and mainly with China. We cannot admit that we open our European markets to third parties, and these third parties are closing their markets and their public procurement to European companies. We have to struggle for a level playing field in our trade relations with countries that are no more developing countries, and I'm speaking specifically of China, and the needs we have to reform the WTO in order to address this new situation. And I wish that the European policies and the national policies of the member states can invest more in their own industry, in their own infrastructures, in their own technologies, and in their own ecosystems of innovation, technology, and education. So I do think, referring to certain slogans that were very popular within us, that we still need what we usually call the enabling state, the state that provides conditions for people and companies to create through important education systems, social security systems, and public infrastructures. But at the same time, we need this strategic role the state can play.
But in this case, we're talking not just about the state as, say, the government of Portugal, we're also talking about the state per the European Commission. Yeah. So let me ask you, from a Portuguese point of view, how much European Commission interference would you welcome or tolerate in your use of the recovery funds resources? And in striking that balance between openness, competition, and, you know, and European production? I mean, if the European Commission comes to you and says, look, I think you need to do things in a different way. I don't think you're emphasizing enough the productivity goals that Portugal should be pursuing. How much interference would you tolerate from the Commission in that context?
If I may answer by the practical example of Portugal, what we don't tolerate is what happened with the assistant program, with the Troika between 2010 and 2015. At that time, Portugal, not only Portugal, Greece, Ireland, Cyprus, and in a certain way, Italy and Spain were submitted to an assistant program. In the Portuguese case, a program that was ruled by IMF, ECB, and the Commission. And the logic of that program was this one. We assessed your financial and budgetary situation. You need to do this and this and that. You have the money. If you do what we want you to do. This is not.
I know you push back against that sort of subordination, and I understand why. But equally, Augusta, you know that there are Northern European member states who were very nervous about, you know, about whether the money would be spent well and whether it really would be a disciplined process. Isn't it reasonable that the Commission acts on their behalf as much as it does on your behalf?
Of course. And that's why we don't refuse budgetary discipline. We don't refuse long-term assessments and decisions. And that's why the logic of the national recovery plans is very different from the logic of the assistance program I described. And this logic of the national recovery plans is the earthquake logic. Because what we are doing is saying to the member states, you have a certain amount of money, both grants and loans you can use to foster your recovery, your quick recovery. And in order to have your national plans approved, you need to meet these three criteria. You have to spend at least 37% in climate action related measures. You have to allocate at least 30% to digitalization, and you have to respond to the country's specific recommendations. So you have to present a certain number of reforms. That said, it is your responsibility. It is the responsibility of your government, of your parliament, to design and to approve your national plan. The Commission will assess it, the Council will approve it, but it is not the official of the European Commission plus the official of the ECB plus the official of the International Monetary Fund that we are going to prescribe to you, to design instead of you, the program you have to follow if you want the money. No, it is your government, your parliament that have to decide how are you going to implement your reforms, what kind of investments you are doing, are you going to do.
But when I think of Portugal also, I think of, you know, a really large and vibrant small and medium-sized enterprise sector. I mean, it represents such a vibrant and important part of your economy. And I also think of, obviously, of your hospitality sector as well, because as you know, until the British government stopped us, you know, tens of thousands of Brits were flocking over to Portugal very recently to enjoy the delights of your hospitality sector.
I have a proposal too. You can come to do your holidays in Portugal, then you return to England, you choose some novels.
Yeah.
For instance, those novels of Dickens or Lawrence that you had read a long time ago.
And have a happy quarantine.
Yes, and you have a useful quarantine.
So you mean,
sorry, I interrupted you.
Come to Portugal then and have a double holiday.
Holiday
in Portugal, then the quarantine.
Then literature.
Tell me, do you think the Recovery Fund actually could have done more for SMEs? Do you think that this big picture frame of the Recovery Fund is aiming off too much the small and medium-sized enterprises of Portugal and other European countries?
Well, I think that we needed to arrange different parts in a coherent mosaic. So, first of all, we need public investment in order to speed up the economic recovery. And some investments that we were postponing concerning, for instance, smart mobility, trains instead of planes, can be done immediately. And this, of course, will be very important to speed up the recovery. Then you have to have the adequate incentives for small and medium enterprises. Our national plan is designed in order to underline the incentives to joint ventures, to associations between enterprises and the science and technology ecosystem. And then third element, you have to profit from this national plan to address also these kind of difficulties or fragilities the pandemic has unveiled. I'm referring, of course, to healthcare equipments, or and also to the kind of fragilities, vulnerabilities concerning, for instance, immigrants, concerning old people, and concerning poorer communities, that in a certain sense the pandemic has unveiled. So these three elements are all necessary. And if you think logically and systemically, you can see that this can be a very good combination of public investment in infrastructures, communications, and material infrastructures, economic innovation and technological adjustment, and the social dimension that I was saying that it is so important.
Before we leave the economy, one other dimension, of course, is that of trade. And the very difficult time we've had during the last 4 years in sparking trade disputes between the European Union and the United States. The EU-US summit today was to see some welcome commitments to resolving some of these disputes. And there was also a proposal to create a trade and technology council that would bring convergence in policy standards and thinking in relation to the main technology platforms and the emerging technologies like AI. Are you encouraged by what you hear from the EU-US summit today? Has it gone in the right direction?
Yes, I'm encouraged indeed. But I think that we have to think with your help, with the help of many think tanks, with the help of the academia, in what will be in the next future the trade policy of the European Union. I'm quite worried about that. First of all, because there are agreements that are being designed without us. For instance, if you think on the Economic Regional Comprehensive Partnership that joined last November, China, Japan, Korea, all the Asian, the Southeast countries, New Zealand and Australia, there are three global players that are missing in this arrangement: India, the European Union, and the United States. And of course, neither the European Union nor the United States can ignore this fact that 14 countries of Asia, including China, have by now the most comprehensive economic agreement ever designed. On the other hand, there is a current stalemate in Europe concerning the ratification of our agreement with Mercosur countries. And in some member states and European Parliament, and even in our national parliaments, many stakeholders are saying that in order to have a trade agreement, you have to agree on any other non-commercial issue of your relationship. And I think this is quite dangerous for the trade policy of Europe.
Well, I'm very interested you say that, because when I was trade commissioner, I introduced to the commission, which was agreed by the commission, I introduced it to the council, it was agreed by the council, I introduced to the European Parliament, and it was agreed by the European Parliament, a global Europe strategy, which provided for the EU's economic engagement with the rest of the world, notably in Asia, but not only, but notably in Asia, where I felt that the European Union was striking the right balance between openness and the ability to defend its own interests, but also our concentration on trade and commercial opportunities, rather than a raft of other social and environmental issues, which frankly were very difficult to negotiate with third countries and oftentimes stood in the way of our agreements on trade. Now, I feel that over the last decade, we've moved away from that equation and that sort of rather more balanced equation. And the emphasis is now more on pursuing social and environmental objectives at the expense of trade, including with Asia. You seem to be saying the same thing to me.
Yes, indeed. For me, it's very simple. It's simple to say, not to make. But it's simple to say that any environmental or social element that harms the principle of level playing field must be addressed in a trade agreement. For instance, if you are trading with a country that practices forced labor, of course, you have to put as a sine qua non condition of your relationship with that country the end, the respect of that country for the ILO conventions. But you cannot transform a trade agreement in a kind of passe-partout of absolutely comprehensive, absolutely global bilateral treaty with your equivalent, with other nations, because first of all, this is not logic. Secondly, at the end of the day, you are trading with yourself, and we want a Europe that is open. And thirdly, if you allow me, because I'm a foreign minister, you cannot devaluate the geopolitical importance of trade. My first argument in favor of the ratification of the Mercosur agreement is a geopolitical one. That's the main instrument we have now to reinforce our relations with Latin America. 10 years or 20 years ago, the United States was the first trade partner of Latin America, and then came Europe. Right now is China, then United States, then Europe. And you have to think geopolitically. First you have to think, and then you have to think geopolitical.
But isn't, Augusto, isn't the problem that, for example, in relation, or notably in relation to China, people are thinking too geopolitically? That they are now saying, look, okay, China is the second biggest, soon to become biggest, certainly the biggest trading nation in the world, yet we must put issues of human rights and labor rights before our economic interests in Europe. Do you not think that we are in danger in Europe of getting almost out of balance our position in relation to China? I mean, at the moment, that relationship is characterized by a mixture of partnership, competition, and rivalry. Do you not think that we are in danger of allowing the geopolitical rivalry to get in the way of fair competition and, where it's necessary, proper partnership with China?
Yes, well, it's a difficult but necessary balance. Of course, if we want to achieve as a world the 2050 targets of carbon neutrality, you have to count with China, not only with China, with India, or with Russia, with Mexico, with Indonesia, and so forth. And then you have to balance your economic relationship with China. And I feel the need to this rebalancing. And at a certain, to a certain extent, the agreement on the protection of investment that was concluded in the last days of the German presidency last year is going in that direction, rebalancing our economic relation with China. And then we have to be firm and precise in our red lines concerning the geopolitical relationship. We cannot admit that the freedom of navigation in the South China Sea can be put in question. We have to be very firm contesting the events or the evolution in Hong Kong liberties. And of course, we have to be very clear, very cautious in what regards the relationship towards Taiwan. And of course, we cannot ignore the fact that in the Xinjiang province, it's happening a lot of violations of human rights.
But Portugal is a country that welcomes foreign investment, including investment from China. I mean, are you now in Portugal becoming more cautious about Chinese investment? I mean, are you more concerned about the strings or the risks that come with that investment, or the opinion of other member states in the European Union about it?
Well, I must say that in Portugal, we are very happy with the presence and the relevance of foreign investment in our economy, because including from China. But we are happy with the current hierarchy in the foreign investments. Our main, in terms of nations, our main foreign investor is Germany, then comes France, then, our economic integration with Spain is obvious, but then comes the United Kingdom, then comes the United States, then Belgium or Italy, then China. And this is a quite good picture, because we are a nation open to trade and for investment, and we need capital. We have abundant resources in terms of human resources, but we have a lack of capital because of the way we did the democratic transition and our peripheral position. So we need capital, we need know-how, and of course the foreign investment is a very good driver of technological transfer and economic modernization. But again, we think that the European integration has to be also envisaged in terms, in economic terms, and in terms of our relations and investment. And then comes our Atlantic environment. We are an Atlantic country, so we are very close to you, the British, and to the Americans.
Let me ask you in the final minutes that we have in our conversation, and time has just flown past. I'm rather sorry it's flown so quickly, but let me ask you both about the United States and the United Kingdom, last of all. First of all, the US. You said in December that you hoped that Mr. Biden's election would usher in a new age of transatlantic relations. We've now had the G7, we've had the NATO summit and the US-EU summit today. All of it has gone in a way that would have been unimaginable under President Trump. Is this new age that you referred to before now successfully emerging, in your view?
Yes, I would say yes, very firmly. Not only because there is a kind of realignment between the European Union and the United States, because in a certain way, the United States are joining European Union in one, in some of our main agendas. And last but not least, because this provides the room to speak to each other on our divergences, on our objective contradictions, for instance, regarding trade, for instance, regarding economic elements. We cannot ignore the divergences between the European Union and the United States. Of course, the idea...
I mean, the
American is not an European formula.
Well, we've already seen, still under President Biden, a failure to consult European partners on the withdrawal from Afghanistan, for example, a failure to consult the EU on intellectual property, on vaccines. And Mr. Biden is making it very clear that he wants to protect the American worker from too much competition, including European competition.
It's very different.
His language is different. His language is very different, and his
attitude,
both his actual language and his body language. But aren't we seeing, in some respects, a continuation of American policy from Trump to Biden?
You could say that we can see a continuation of American policy from Obama to Biden through Trump in certain dimensions. But it's very different to address difficult issues as friends, as we do with Mr. Biden, and to address these same difficulties when you are treated as enemies or adversaries, like Mr. Trump usually did. But may I expose my personal thesis? My personal thesis is that we would make a serious mistake in European Union, if we reduced our critical relationship to the relationship with the United States. We need a triangle, and the triangle is formed by the European Union, United States, and United Kingdom. That's the very Portuguese view. In a certain way, for us, Europe is not enough.
Let's come on to Britain in a moment, but just before I leave the United States, I mean, it was during Mr. Trump's presidency that, you know, Europe started to develop and proclaim its doctrine of strategic autonomy. And we can understand why Europe needed to think more in terms of its self-reliance during a Trump presidency. Are you saying to me that now that Mr. Biden is here and that new era has been ushered in, we don't need to emphasize our strategic autonomy so much? Or are you saying, well, we have to hedge our bets here? You never know, in 2024, we may have another Trump-like president, or indeed Trump himself coming back. So we better maintain a degree of autonomy, because we can't actually rely on the United States in the long term in the way that we previously assumed we could.
I must say that as a Portuguese minister and as a pro-European politician, I don't need the adjective. I only need to say we have to enhance European autonomy. I don't need the word strategic, because people can misunderstand this formula. When we speak of strategic autonomy, we are speaking mostly of economy. We are speaking mostly of the provision of public goods, basic goods, we consider as basic goods, from facial masks to critical communications networks, for instance. So I am personally, I avoid to use the expression strategic autonomy when I'm speaking of issues of security and defense, because the strategic autonomy of Europe in that domain is against third powers, but it is inside NATO. So it is in close alliance with the United Kingdom, Canada, and the United States. So as I am not a French, I can skip the adjective strategic. But I understand your point, and it's very important for us with President Biden, as we did with President Trump, to say that we are partners. So it is not a question of our American friends asking European Union or the United Kingdom, on which side are you? You are with us, following our leadership, or you are against us because you are with China or too complacent with China. This is not the way of putting things. We have a very solid, strong, a very important partnership with the United States, but we are partners, we are not followers. And the idea of the European autonomy, strategic in that sense, is this one, that we need to reinforce the position of European Union as a global player, as you say.
Well, given that you are Portuguese rather than French, you have an age-old alliance with the United Kingdom, one of your oldest, one of our oldest alliances in the world. Let me ask you quickly and lastly, because we've run out of time, Northern Ireland, and I'm a former Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. I implemented the Good Friday Agreement when I was Northern Ireland Secretary. The complexity of Northern Ireland is now absolutely at the heart of the EU-UK relationship. Tell me this, how well do you think the complexity of Northern Ireland and its communal relations and history is understood in European national capitals? I'm not talking about the rights and wrongs of the Northern Ireland Protocol, leave that aside. But do you think that in national capitals across Europe, the complexity, the subtlety of the situation in Northern Ireland is perhaps appreciated as much as it could be?
No. We should pay more attention to Northern Ireland and to the Northern Ireland issue. And of course, it is important to say to our British friends, you have to comply with the rules of the agreements you decided to sign with us, but it is not sufficient to say this. We have to understand, as you rightly said, the subtleties of the Northern Ireland experience. But one thing is clear, or should be clear to all of us. The Good Friday agreements cannot be put in question directly or indirectly. You have to preserve the kind of agreement, the kind of harmony, the kind of arrangement that in very difficult circumstances and benefiting from the important role of several statesmen from the United Kingdom, but from both sides in Northern Ireland were obtained. So we have to keep this in mind. Always thinking not as the chief of a sectoral department, but as politicians. It is not only trade, it is not only the circulation of people, it's an history, it's an arrangement, it's a circumstance, and we have to understand it.
That was a very statesmanlike note on which to complete our conversation, which has been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for your time and for your insights. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. All the best.
Bye.
For more insights, blogs, and analysis, you can visit our website, www.global-council.com, and subscribe to our mailing list. And you can follow us on Twitter @global_council.